Looking to unlock uncapped upside from largest and most recognized NASDAQ 100 names, bolstered by the potential income and diversification benefits of bonds? Look to ticker CANQ, the Calamos Alternative NASDAQ and Bond ETF. CANQ delivers options-based exposure to NASDAQ 100 stocks, combining the risk mitigation and income benefits of a fixed income foundation. Upside NASDAQ 100 potential, manageable downside risk, while seeing monthly income along the way. That's a ticker worth researching. Demand more from your NASDAQ equity allocation. Explore ticker CANQ, the Calamos Alternative NASDAQ and Bond ETF. To learn more about CANQ, visit calamos.com/CANQ. Before investing, carefully consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Please see the prospectus and summary prospectus containing this and other information, which can be obtained by calling 1-866-363-9219. Read it carefully before investing. An investment in the fund is subject to risks, and you could lose money on your investment in the funds. There can be no assurance that the funds will achieve its investment objective. Your investment in the fund is not a deposit in a bank and is not insured or guaranteed by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or any other government agency. The risks associated with an investment in the fund can increase during times of significant market volatility. More detailed information regarding these risks can be found in the fund's prospectus. NASDAQ and NASDAQ 100 are registered trademarks of NASDAQ, Inc., distributed by Calamos Financial Services, LLC.
ETF Prime is hosted by Nate Geraci, president of investment advisory firm, The ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. Some guests appearing on this program may also be financial sponsors of ETF Prime. The ETF Store is not affiliated with VettaFi or any of its affiliates. VettaFi's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or indication by VettaFi of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, joining me will be Chris Davis, Chairman and Portfolio Manager at Davis Advisors, who currently offers four ETFs, over $1.1 billion in assets, though, of course, Davis manages some $25 billion overall. I'm guessing many of you are already pretty familiar with Chris, who I would say has quite the profile on Wall Street, very well-known manager who's been doing this for a long time. So I'm looking forward to this conversation because we are going to touch on those four ETFs, which are all actively managed. But then we're actually going to spend the majority of our time discussing the current stock market environment and how Chris is viewing everything from the top heaviness of market cap weighted indices to the Fed and their approach to interest rates to what it's been like being an active manager over the past 15 years or so since the global financial crisis. Obviously, that hasn't always been easy. So this should be a great conversation with truly one of the best there is in the business. Now, to start this week, I'm now joined by Laura Krieger, Editor-in-Chief at VettaFi. And this is going to be fun. We have several very juicy ETF topics to dive into. I would say much more industry-focused topics versus maybe investor-focused topics, but I have no doubt you're going to find these interesting. So let's chat with Laura now.
Now we're joined by the experts at VettaFi, a new data analytics and thought leadership company that is transforming financial services from an industry to a community, one relationship at a time.
There's a couple of different ways to slice and dice these various ETFs. They can hold what are called total return swaps. Expect the unexpected.
Laura, great having you back on the podcast. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me today.
All right. So as we like to do from time to time, I have a grab bag of ETF topics this week. And I want to start with something I briefly touched on last week, which is pay to play in the ETF space. So I call this the industry's dirty little secret. And this has sort of bubbled back up to the surface recently after it was reported that Fidelity is going to charge a $100 fee, $100 to their clients who want to buy ETFs from 9 ETF issuers at this point, including Simplify and Access Investments. Since those firms were refusing to pay for a quote-unquote maintenance arrangement. Now, let me color this a little bit. This type of situation isn't new, right? Gatekeeping has long been a practice in the asset management space from brokerages and advisors platforms. This goes back to the mutual fund glory days a long time ago, where if fund companies wanted access to those platforms, they had to pay up. But of course, this practice hasn't gone away. And so to start, here is my question for you. Do you think this is actually going to become a bigger trend now that someone like Fidelity seems to be getting pretty brazen with this here? Like again, I know this has already been going on for a long time, but a $100 fee, that catches my attention. And so do you think major platforms are going to get even more aggressive with this moving forward?
I like it that you're leading with something spicy today. This is great. So you said it yourself that this has already been an issue in the industry. It's hard to imagine that it's going to get to be a bigger issue because it's already, as you said, so widespread. Pay to play is kind of just the law of the land at this point. So The Financial Times reported this fee that Fidelity was asking these 9 issuers to pay. This morning, they reported it as 15% of the total fund revenue for that issuer's ETFs. And that's higher than I think most people realize. They're not the only platform that's doing something like this. Charles Schwab also charges a fee to some ETF sponsors of as high as 10%. So, Fidelity says that these fees are what help keep their online trading platform running efficiently and securely. And almost all ETF issuers are paying it. Although, here's the catch. They don't all pay the same amount. It does vary by sponsor, which, doesn't seem necessarily fair to me on the face, but I also don't run a trading platform. So maybe Fidelity was hoping that by levying a $100 charge per trade, they were going to bring these 9 issuers into compliance with everybody else. And maybe they were hoping that, pressure from investors would be so intense that the issuers would have no choice but to pony up. But gosh, what a huge PR backfire for Fidelity. I think the optics here are just astonishingly bad because, like you said, pay to play, it's been the lay of the law, the lay of the land here for decades, and it always impacts the smallest issuers the most because they're the ones that don't necessarily have the spare cash on hand to pay the racket money, right? They're the ones that maybe have the hardest time getting on platform in the first place. And so they have no choice but to pass this extra cost onto their investors. So they end up having higher fees, which hurts them in the hunger games of the fee wars that is the ETF industry, right? So it's, that would be one thing. But it's not just issuers who are upset by this move. Investors are pretty outraged from what I've seen too. Because let's face it, paying per trade kind of stinks, right? We generally haven't seen trading commissions as a matter of course for the past 5 to 10 years, and there's a reason for that. And look, a service fee isn't the same as a trade commission, but in this case, it's going to feel the same, especially when you consider that for many retail investors, they're not buying huge lots of stocks. They might buy only a few $100 of shares at a time. So in that sense, this is even worse than a trading commission because those were like $5 or $10 a trade and this is $100. So when investors see their bill and they're going to get mad, they're not going to get mad at Simplify or Axis or any of the other issuers. They're going to get mad at the platform that imposed the fee or Fidelity. So, again, just a huge, huge misstep from Fidelity here, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would. Let me pull on several threads there because you threw out a lot, which I think this is a great topic. I agree this is an unforced error by Fidelity. But I'm going to spin this a little bit in a positive fashion in that we wouldn't be talking about this if they didn't make this move. And that's important because I said this has been the industry's dirty little secret. This has kind of been something that's just gone on behind the scenes. And now with this action by Fidelity, it is bringing it to the forefront. I think that's a good thing, so we can shine a light on some of these practices. And, you know, you mentioned how different sponsors may be charged different fees. Obviously, that's going to disproportionately hurt smaller ETF issuers who don't have the financial wherewithal that some of the larger issuers have. And I want to read you a quote. So MarketWatch had an article on this last week where Jason Hsu, who's a founder of Reliant, they offer several actively managed ETFs, and they're one of the nine issuers on Fidelity's list. He said, in some ways, this is an existential threat. He said, quote, if no one buys your ETF, you just die. And, you know, this is straight from the mouth of an issuer who was actually dealing with this. And I've had Jason on the podcast in the past. I mean, we're talking about a smart, smart individual with some unique ETFs. And I just hate seeing something like this because to what you were saying, this isn't a $5 commission or $10 commission. This is $100. That's going to dissuade pretty much any investor from buying these ETFs. So I guess that's one thing that I'll point out. The other, you may have seen this last week, Wes Gray, who, of course, you know, CEO of Alpha Architect. He's also behind the white label ETF provider ETF Architect. So he tweeted, quote, we get the following question almost every day. I went to buy your strategy mutual fund or ETF at big bank broker. So he's talking about UBS, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Merrill, Wells Fargo, et cetera. And he said, your ticker is blocked because of due diligence. What's up? And Wes, he said, the answer is we haven't engaged in their pay-to-play scheme yet. And then he provided a deep dive article into how big bank distribution works behind the scenes, which I highly encourage everyone to read that. But my point in bringing up that tweet is, again, this shows you this is a real thing that has real impact, this pay to play in terms of what's made available to end investors. And I guess I'd be curious, Laura, from your standpoint, like can you put any context around that, around just how impactful this could be to smaller ETF issuers in particular?
Well, I think the example you provided, both of the examples, put it any much more eloquently than I could have. I completely agree with Jason. This is an existential threat for smaller ETF issuers. And it isn't, it can't be stated any more clearly than that. Because if you're, look, backing up a second, What do we know about ETF investors? Why do they buy certain ETFs? We know they buy ETFs because of performance and because of fees. Two ETFs that stack up the same performance, same objective, same holdings next to each other, but one's cheaper, they're always, I mean, history has proven they're going to go for the one that's cheaper. Fee wars are a real thing in the ETF space. We're all trying to claw back whatever pennies on the dollar that we can when it comes to using ETFs. So if you suddenly, you're a any ETF issuer, big or small, suddenly, investors are going to have to pay an exorbitant fee to buy even a single share of your ETF, that's going to hurt you quite a bit. So look, I think this is probably, like I said, the optics are so bad here. It makes it look like Fidelity is, or any of these trading platforms really that engage in these revenue share programs are mobsters squeezing the small issuers for protection money, right? It's not a good look. And, but that said, like all of that said, trading platforms do already charge service fees in a lot of different ways, right? Just because you're not paying a trade commission on online trading of US equity ETFs, doesn't mean you aren't paying fees elsewhere, right? So it is common to pay per trade fees for trades you make by broker or trades you make by phone. Or Fidelity charges $33 for rep-assisted trades, and they make a few pennies on every sell order, no matter what the order size is or what the lot size is. You have to pay trade commissions on fixed income and over-the-counter stocks and options. So, like, you're already getting kind of nickeled and dimed. And I'm not providing this info as a way to defend pay-to-play. I think it's pretty obvious I feel quite the opposite about revenue sharing in that regard. I'm just saying that it's already really egregious, and it's not just limited to Fidelity. So this is, like, one case where it was slightly less egregious in the sense that we had agreed to that paying money per trade to buy equity ETFs online was not a thing we wanted to do anymore. And Fidelity just decided to swing hard in the other direction. So we'll see how that works out for them. I do think other platforms are watching this very closely. And if Fidelity doesn't really see any repercussions from its customers about this, then yeah, I think you could potentially see this kind of arrangement be adopted more broadly across the industry, again, for online trading. You know, let them know how you feel, I guess. So, but it's something I'm going to be watching very closely.
Yeah, and one thing I just want to expand on, and you were alluding to this earlier, it's not just this $100 fee that may be charged to end investors. You have to think about this longer term, and that ultimately, if an ETF issuer says, okay, we have to pay this whatever 15% of fund revenue to Fidelity and other platforms. If you're an ETF issuer, what are you going to do? Well, you're going to charge a higher expense ratio to cover that 15% revenue share. In the Financial Times piece you referenced this morning, Laura, there was an ETF issuer, Regent Park Funds. They're one of the nine ETF firms that's on that Fidelity list. There's a quote from David Young, the CEO there. He said, "The next ETF we come out with, we're going to go to the market with the maximum fee we can justify." Point being here that, you know, at the top I said we're going to talk more industry-focused topics versus maybe investor-focused, but that has a real impact on investors. That's fees going up because at the end of the day, ETF issuers have to make money. And so, you know, there's only so much to go around here. I just think that's important to point out. It's not just that $100 trading fee. It's that ETF issuers will likely have to increase their expense ratios. But let me ask you this, Laura, and we'll move on here in a minute because I want to get to some other topics. But if I'm Fidelity, let's be somewhat fair here in that Fidelity is a for-profit business. They're trying to make money too, just like ETF issuers. And you were saying earlier that, you know, you're not going to be one to defend pay-to-play. I don't think I am either, but I also respect the fact that if somebody's operating a business, they have an opportunity to make money the way that they see fit, as long as it's legal. And so my question is, what do you think the right answer or solution is here? Or do you think this is just the way it's going to be moving forward? Is there an alternative?
I think first I may be the wrong person to ask because I'm always going to take the side of there should be fewer fees levied on the issuers to get their funds in front of investors. I think it's better for investors that way. I think it's better for issuers. It makes them more competitive, and fairer industry. And that has been sort of the guiding value of the ETF industry since its inception, is democratizing access, right? So things like this don't, they run counter to the idea of democratizing access. But assuming that pay to play and revenue sharing is just how it has to be, I think it would be fair if, for starters, everybody had to pay the same amount, that certain ETF issuers weren't paying more than others, that these fees were better disclosed, not just to issuers, of course, but also to investors, so that maybe they would have that understanding of when they look at a newer ETF from a smaller issuer and they say, whoa, that's a huge price tag. Where's that price tag coming from? Well, as you said earlier, sometimes you have to charge the maximum amount you can, that you can justify so that you can get your ETF out into the world. Not excusing that by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm just saying that's an explanation there. I think more information is better, and a fairer playing ground where everybody is being charged maybe the same flat amount, and it doesn't vary. It's very well disclosed, and it's not 15% of their total revenue from the fund, but maybe there's a this is why I'm not in charge of a trading platform.
You hit the two that that I had here as I was thinking through what a potential solution is, because it's easy for me to come on this podcast and just complain and make some argument. But okay, how do you fix this? And one, I agree, level the playing field. There needs to be some consistency in how these fees are charged, and not, again, negatively and disproportionately impact smaller ETF issuers. The other big one is clearly transparency. Let's shine a big light on this, because that gets into the competitive dynamics. If you're an end investor and you know Fidelity's charging ETF issuers, say, 15% to be on their platform, but maybe another platform's only charging 5%, and I say only in air quotes, only charging 5%, well, at least you as an investor know that. And maybe you go, you know what, I'm going to support the platform that's only charging 5% to ETF issuers. Those sorts of things, right? Where you have disclosure, there's transparency, so end investors can make an educated decision around their purchases. So this is an interesting topic. I think you're right in that Fidelity has made, I'm going to say they've made an error here, because again, this is now out in the open. But the good of that is we're going to continue to talk about it, and I'll be very interested to see how other platforms react here. Okay.
I would not be surprised.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I wouldn't be surprised if they walked this back.
I wouldn't either. I wouldn't either. But again, this has been going on a long time. And so, walking back, okay, maybe they don't charge a $100 fee, but that 15% isn't going away. All right. So I don't know. I just I'll be very interested to see how this plays out. Okay, another story I want to ask you about, and this was in the news last week, is that SIBO has filed with the SEC to allow fund companies to offer ETF share classes of existing mutual funds. I believe we currently have 8 fund companies, if I'm not mistaken, that have filed for this structure, including firms like Dimensional and Fidelity and Morgan Stanley. But this is now getting support from an exchange in SIBO. So can you explain why that's important? Why is SIBO doing this?
Yeah, absolutely. And this, I think, is one of the most underappreciated big stories in the ETF industry right now. Multi-share class structures were one of the most talked about issues at exchange. Every lawyer, every issuer I spoke to pinpointed this as the thing that they're keeping their eye on for the next 12 months. So just to set the scene a little bit here, in the year 2000, Vanguard files this patent on offering ETFs as a share class of their existing index-based mutual funds. The SEC agrees, and for a long time, Vanguard's the only issuer who can do this, and it gives them just this enormous leg up on the competition when it comes to tax efficiency across their entire portfolio, both ETFs and mutual funds alike. And I can get into the why of that in just a second if you like, but in May of last year, Vanguard's patent expired, and like you said, 8 issuers petitioned the SEC to be allowed to do the same thing. But the thing is, those applications have been stuck at the SEC for almost a year at this point. So along comes SIBO last week with its 19B4 filing. And what a 19B4 is, it's a rule change filing. It's basically the exchange telling the SEC, we're going to change the rules on what we can and cannot list on our exchange unless you explicitly tell us not to. And these filings got a lot of attention in the run-up to the spot Bitcoin ETF launch, because as part of the launch process, exchanges needed to explicitly change their rule sets to allow trading of those exceptional structures. So SIBO is telling the SEC, we want to list these multi-share class structures, and any ETF that's going to follow the structure would have to go through an old process of filing for exemptive relief and all of that, but we still want to offer them to our traders. So to your question, what's special about the exchange saying this and not an issuer is that the 19B4 filing starts a clock. Now the SEC can't just push the buck. They have to weigh in, and they have to weigh in within 240 days or otherwise the rule change just takes effect. So you might be wondering, like, why are they doing this now? Is SIBO trying to force the hand of the regulator? I mean, maybe they are, right? The SEC has voiced concerns that there might be potential conflicts of interest at work here, right? If issuers have mutual fund shares and ETF shares linked to the same main structure, are they going to prioritize one structure over the other in marketing? Or are they going to vote their shares differently or whatever? I don't know. But the SEC isn't falling over itself to find out. So maybe SIBO is trying to speed up the slow walk here. But the other possibility is that maybe SIBO is trying to get ahead of the game, because if these multi-share class vehicles get approved by the SEC, then the exchanges would have to file this rule change anyway, because ETFs need to go through these structures, need to go through a special exemptive relief process to come to launch. And so whenever that's the case, an exchange has to change the rules in order to list them. So SIBO's filing says this in multiple spots, that they're just trying to prevent any unnecessary delays in getting products listed. So, you know, getting ahead of the game. So in any case, this filing was filed last week. So I think by my count, the SEC has until late November, early December to weigh in. And, you know, clock is ticking.
I know we've talked about this in the past, but I'm curious, do you have any updated views on how the SEC might handle this? Like, do you think it's possible for the structure to be approved later this year, or is this more of a 2025? Obviously, again, as you described, SIBO now is forcing the SEC to respond. They're starting that clock. What do you think happens?
There could be some volatility. Like, what they may want to do is push it off until 2025, but I don't think they can push it off indefinitely. Like we saw with the spot Bitcoin ETFs, they just kept on pushing and pushing and pushing. I don't think that's going to be the case here. There may be some volatility at the SEC, you know, with regards to an upcoming election, and maybe some new people are going to be put in seat. And you know how those things always kind of impact the flow of bureaucracy, right? As far as my feelings on whether or not these will be approved in the first place, I think they will be approved. I don't see any big stumbling blocks, despite the objections raised by the SEC. They don't seem like huge stumbling blocks to me. But I do think that they're going to, all of these eight issuers, we're going to see kind of a repeat of what happened with the Bitcoin ETFs, in that there's going to be a big slew of approvals at once, right? So the idea of like first in, first to approve, I'm not so sure that that's going to be the case here. I'm not so sure that's been the case even before the spot Bitcoin ETFs were approved. Like, for example, the semi-transparent active ETFs, if you remember when those were approved, those structures, there were multiple proposals in the pipeline, and they were all sort of approved at the same time. Same thing with spot Bitcoin ETFs, multiple proposals, they were all kind of approved at the same time. And so here, same idea, you have multiple proposals. I think they're all going to be approved at the same time.
You've mentioned the spot Bitcoin ETF several times, obviously a huge story this year. But you noted earlier that the ETF share class structure is an underappreciated big story. Is there anything bigger now in the ETF space than that, or is that the big story for the remainder of the year?
No, I think this is the biggest one. And the reason I think this is going to be so big is because if this structure gets approved, then the floodgates that, you've heard me say over the past couple years, ever since the ETF rule was passed in 2019, that, oh, the floodgates are open. And now this is the reason why we're seeing so many new issuers and smaller issuers and active ETF issuers coming to market, is because of the ETF rule. We've seen a Cambrian explosion of ETFs coming to launch because of the ETF rule.
Laura, just about 2 minutes left here. If the ETF share class structure is the biggest story in ETFs, I'm curious, is there an under-the-radar ETF story you're tracking right now? I know you like playing in the ETF weeds a little bit. Is there anything particularly interesting to you right now that maybe isn't getting a ton of attention?
Yeah. So I, am a commodities girl to my soul, right? So I've been keeping a close eye on what's going on in the commodity space, and particularly in cocoa, right? So cocoa futures have been hitting record highs lately due to supply disruptions and, even a crop disease called the swollen shoot virus and so on. So cocoa is trading at, last I checked yesterday, $9,700, which is just frankly insane. So, you could go plow your money into a cocoa ETN. There's a iPath Bloomberg Cocoa ETN, ticker NIB. It's a pure play option. I don't love the idea of buying an investment when it's at all-time highs. You know, kind of just sets you up for buying high and selling low, you know. But there is some other options out there for investors who want access to, the price appreciation potential of commodities. Also want to stay tactical in the space. One fund I find just absolutely fascinating is this one from Tucrium called the ILA Long Short Agriculture Strategy ETF. And that's ticker OAIA. And it uses AI to sift through which futures it should be going long in and which it should be going short on. And look, you know, I've said it on this podcast before that I'm kind of a skeptic when it comes to using AI as like a hot, flashy thing in investing. But long short strategies are something that institutions have been doing in commodities forever. And it works, right? That's why they've been doing it. So OAII kind of opens up that strategy to investors. Yeah, it's expensive. It has a management fee of 149 basis points, which is kind of steep. But performance-wise, it's doing really well against its ETF database category peers on a one-year basis, outperforming that ETF database category by over 500 basis points. So, you know, if you're looking for a way to, if you're getting excited about what's going on in commodities and cocoa, you know, there's two options for you.
Well, Laura, we're going to have to leave it there. Fun chat this week on some very important topics, though, right, with pay to play and obviously the ETF share class structure. But fun conversation. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Laura Krieger, Editor-in-Chief at VettaFi.
Understanding the complex fixed income environment is critical to your portfolio's success. VettaFi's Fixed Income Symposium is happening April 18th and brings the experts and thought leaders straight to you. Hear the insights you need to succeed in 2024. Register for free at etftrends.com.
Growth and innovation. Two words that best describe the ETF industry. However, rapid growth and innovation creates a critical need for financial advisors and industry practitioners' education. Enter the ETF Institute, the first and only independent organization providing industry professionals and financial advisors with certification, education, and training on ETFs. Learn more about the Certified ETF Advisor designation by visiting cetf.org.
Davis, Chairman and Portfolio Manager at Davis Advisors, who currently offers four ETFs, over $1.1 billion in assets. These are all actively managed ETFs, all fully transparent ETFs. And of course, Chris himself probably needs no introduction. He's been managing portfolios for over 35 years, very well known on Wall Street, as Davis Advisors manages about $25 billion in assets overall, including the flagship Davis New York Venture Fund. And Chris is now joining me from New York. Chris, it's a pleasure. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Nate. I'm so glad to be here.
All right. So, look, there's a lot I want to get into, certainly including those Davis ETFs. But let's start with some discussion around the broader markets. And you look right now, We have major stock indices near all-time highs, despite interest rates remaining elevated, which I think some investors were expecting the Fed to cut rates fairly aggressively this year. Certainly doesn't look like that'll happen now, with inflation remaining sticky and the economy looking pretty good overall. But to start, just at a high level, how are you viewing the current stock market environment given that backdrop right now?
Well, one of my favorite philosophers once said that the purpose of economic forecasting is to make astrology look respectable. It is amazing what you say about interest rate forecasts. I mean, everybody assumed there would be cuts. Now they don't think there'll be cuts. I mean, it's just so much time is spent trying to predict the unpredictable. And what we always say here is you can't predict, but you can prepare. So if we start with the market index as a whole, we start by saying, look, you can expect a 20% correction roughly every 2.5 or 3 years. That's statistically how often it happens. 10% corrections happen, you know, more than once a year. But whenever you get that, of course, people get all rattled and panicked. So we sort of say, look, there's no reason the market can't be down 20%. In fact, it would be perfectly normal for it to fall in any 2 or 3 year period. So with that, we sort of started to say, well, look, you can't predict this sort of natural volatility. But let's get at the deeper question, Nate, which is the market overvalued here? So forget whether prices are going to gyrate around in the next 18 months. Who the hell knows? But the question is this a terrible starting point? And there, of course, it is. You have to look through at underlying valuation compared to your alternatives. And there I would say, you know, when you look at the indexes overall, they look all right. You know, at the upper end of fair value, when you exclude a handful of the big drivers of this market, it begins to look reasonable. And of course, when you really can be selective the way we are, it begins to look quite attractive. And of course, that is the case for active management that we may well get into. But so there's not one story, but everybody that listens should recognize that anytime, Nate, you have somebody on that tells you that the market is going to correct 20% or that this, they don't know. Nobody has any idea about short-term forecasts. What you have to look at is the absolute levels of valuation. Is this a reasonable time to get started investing?
You mentioned a handful of big drivers in the market. Clearly, one of the big talking points recently has been the top heaviness of market cap weighted indices. And while I would say market breadth has improved somewhat, right, the rally has broadened out a little bit. If you look at the S&P 500 right now, the top five stocks still comprise nearly 25% of the weightings. The top 10 comprise around 34%. How much of a concern is that for you?
Oh, it's a real concern, and it rightly so, because, you know, wonderful saying that we think about a lot is that you can get in a lot more trouble with a good premise than a bad premise. And what we mean by that is a bad premise sort of proves itself out quickly and you don't lose your shirt. But a good premise works for a long time. And the more it works, the more people pile in. It's like a feedback loop until you get something crazy. So let's just look at some examples in my career. I mean, certainly the internet bubble of the late 90s, you know, it created a very similar top-heavy dynamic. We're more extreme now, but where you had underlying, you had a number of companies. You remember in 2000, Nate, you know, active managers like us, the market was down 9%. The index was down 9%. A lot of active managers, particularly those with the value orientation that had stuck to their discipline, it's not like they outperformed by 2 or 3%. Like, we were up 9% that year. So we were 1,800 basis points ahead of the index. And there were managers we admired that were up 20% that year. So in a year when the market was down 9, you had a lot of active managers outperforming dramatically. Well, we are in, similarly, if you think about residential real estate before the financial crisis, all you had to do was ask any lender, and they'd said, oh, don't worry, residential real estate has never had a down year, ever, nationwide. You had pockets, you know, Texas in the 80s or whatever. But nationally, residential home values had never declined nationally in a year, ever. So, of course, that meant you could lend anything. So you got in more trouble with a good premise in the 90s, you know, tech going to the moon in the mid-2000s, all about residential real estate. And we're in a very similar moment now where basically people feel you can't lose money in these big momentum stocks. Technical analysts jump in because the more they go up, the more they tend to go up. And you're getting some crazy valuations. And meanwhile, at the other side, every time somebody piles into the cap-weighted index, they're getting out of maybe an active manager or a more idiosyncratic portfolio, and that is reinforcing the momentum. So we don't know if we're in the extra innings, in the ninth inning, in the seventh inning. We just know that the valuation discrepancies are so wide and the momentum effect has been so strong for so long that there is certainly going to be a come to Jesus period, whether it happens in a burst like it did in 99 and 2000, or whether it happens in a long glacial period where the rest of the market begins to catch up. We don't know, but certainly you're absolutely right, Nate. That top heaviness is a real concern.
Chris, on the topic of valuations, and you were alluding to this a little bit earlier, but when you look at, say, the Magnificent Seven, or just pick your number of mega cap companies here. I know a couple are off to a rough start this year, but I'd love to have you talk more about valuations right now in the sense of, like, are you able to get your head around a stock like NVIDIA or some of these other mega cap names? I know you hold a fairly large position in Meta, in Amazon. So how are you viewing valuations at the top of the cap spectrum here?
Yeah, that's a fabulous question because, of course, what happens, Nate, is that analysts and market commentators come up with some word, like remember the BRICS, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China. And BRICS becomes a thing. Oh, are you in the BRICS or are you not in the BRICS? Well, it's an asinine grouping because those countries have nothing to do with one another. Well, similarly, you know, now what's now the Magnificent Seven, it's had different names in the past. You know, it's just a random grouping of companies who have all done very well, but each company is different. The prospects are different, the valuation is different, the management is different, the competitive position is different. So you're absolutely right. You want to avoid terms like, oh, the Magnificent Seven, and then look through at the individual companies. So John Train, who was a legendary investor and commentator, used to say, investing is the art of the specific. So you want to be specific. So you mentioned NVIDIA. NVIDIA is a magnificently well-positioned company. You could argue a certain amount of that spectacular positioning was a fluke, right? They were making chips for one purpose that ended up being very good at another purpose. They were designed for video games and video processing. They ended up being very good at large language models and AI. But what we do when we look at valuation, we always start by saying, look, Nate, all money is green, right? You know, $10 earned in an AI company is not worth more than $10 earned in a garbage dump, right? It's all worth $10. So what we start with when we look at valuations, we start and say, what would have to happen for you, if you were buying the company at today's price, for you to get a 10% return? So let's look at NVIDIA. NVIDIA currently has a market cap of about, let's call it $2.1 trillion. And today it earns, you know, something like $30-35 billion. So what you would say is, okay, that's 71 times earnings. So the earnings, if you were going to earn 10% on that investment, it would have to earn one-tenth of its market cap today. So that would be $210 billion today. Now, of course, it's not going to earn that. It's only earning $35 or $40 billion. So it's got to get up to $210 trillion. But next year, you'd say, okay, well, it's going to grow a lot. Well, then that you also have to recognize that for you to get 10%, if you've only gotten $35 billion this year, which is like 1.5%, you're going to have to earn, you know, something like 230 billion next year, and so on. So it keeps moving. So it's not impossible. And what I mean by that is, remember that, you know, NVIDIA's earnings have gone up sevenfold in the last 4 years. So it's not impossible for them to go up another 10 times from here. But for that to happen, Apple currently earns $100 billion, let's say, $114 billion. So to get to $210 billion is a lot. To get to it very quickly is a lot. To get to it when other companies are investing an enormous amount to compete, like you saw the Google announcement today on their investment in chip design and so on, it is, all of it is possible. It's just the degree of difficulty is very, very, very high. And so in an investing world, you don't get extra points for a degree of difficulty. So things that are possible but very improbable, we tend to avoid. Now, if you flip over to something like Meta, and you say, okay, well, Meta currently earns more, roughly a little bit more than NVIDIA, and yet it has a market cap that is about, you know, 40% less. So you're getting paid a lot more up front. But here's an interesting thing, Nate, and I'll wrap this up. I could talk about individual companies all day. After all, we're active managers. We like individual companies. But just to give you a number to think about, you know, right now Meta earns roughly what it spends on R&D. So Meta spends about $36 billion on R&D. I think NVIDIA spends about $8 billion, right? So in our view, it's not just that Meta is a lot cheaper on just a straight earnings basis. It's also that the quality of the earnings to us are a lot greater because of the amount it's investing in its future. So that's a good example, just contrasting those two, of why we would own Meta at a much lower valuation, but also with what we think of as much higher quality earnings versus NVIDIA, although we recognize that NVIDIA is spectacularly well positioned. It's just a lot of that it's priced in. It's a little bit like betting in horse races. You know, if you want to bet on a long shot, it can hit. It's just, you know, as Ring Lardner famously said, the race is not always to the swift, nor the fight to the strong, but that's sure the way to bet. And so there's, you know, there's a lot of success priced into those high valuation of a company like NVIDIA, and we just think the risk-reward doesn't pay off for that.
Well, let me ask you this. I loved how you described the degree of difficulty moving forward there, and I know you've talked a lot recently about the end of free money. Right, how we have a much more normalized interest rate environment now versus the interest rate distortion we saw over the past decade plus. I'm just curious, what do you think some of the implications of that are from an investment perspective? Like, what theoretically should be different moving forward versus what we've seen in the recent past, and how does that play into that degree of difficulty?
What a fabulous question. I mean, you know, the way we'd say it is, for all of human history, money has had a price. And what we mean by money has had a price, it means that, look, if I wanted to if you had a herd of goats and I said, hey, I'd love you to lend me 5 of your goats, you would say, well, you have my 5 goats. I'm not getting the milk out of them. So you need to pay me something for me to be giving up the productive use of my asset. So that's what interest rates are. Interest rates are the cost of me letting you use a productive asset of mine for some period of time and my wanting to be reimbursed for the lost production of that asset. So all of human history, going all the way back to Babylon, money has had a cost until this crazy period that we went through over the last decade, where interest rates functionally came to zero. Now, when interest rates were near zero, there were two things we knew. One, it had never happened, and two, that it was unsustainable because it didn't make sense. Why would you ever give up productive use of an asset if you're not going to be paid for it, right? Why would you defer spending money now if it wasn't going to have any return to letting somebody else use that in the meantime. Now, what were the investment implications of that crazy period? Well, it meant that earnings that were a long way away from now were worth almost the same as earnings today. Who cares when you get them if there's no discount rate? And so that really favored aggressive growth companies, high valuations. It favored speculation and optimism. It penalized the sorts of companies that we tend to like, which are companies where we say the earnings that are produced today are worth more than earnings in the future, because earnings in the future are less certain, and you have to discount them to the present value because you don't get the earnings for a few years. So the higher that discount rate, the less remote earnings are worth, just on a mathematical basis. And when you combine that with the fact that capitalism is brutal, so competition comes in. We spoke about NVIDIA. NVIDIA is a spectacular company, but if you aren't going to get your $210 billion for 5 or 6 years or 7 years, that gives a lot of time for companies like Google and Amazon and others to really work on trying to create a competitive technology that will undermine your pricing power and your margin. So we think that as interest rates normalize, you're returning to an environment of common sense where, you know, every business is worth the present value of its future cash flows. The present value has to be discounted at a rate that makes some sense. As that happens, you're beginning to see a return to the sort of discipline that for us has worked for 50 years, most of the last 50 years, but it really didn't work in this period. And we kept thinking, as you know, are we in a totally new era? Well, it sure felt like it. But because it didn't make sense, zero interest rates did not make sense, we knew it wasn't sustainable. We just didn't know how long. As I said with the others, we didn't know if we were in extra innings or in the ninth inning or the seventh. We just knew that, you know, money, functionally free money, was not something that could last. And if we stuck to our discipline, sooner or later it would pay off. And I think that's what we started to see last year and that we're continuing to see now.
I'm glad you mentioned that last point, because I was very curious as an active manager how you dealt with that period. You called this a crazy period that, you know, did you ever just want to throw your hands up in the air? Or was it fairly easy to maintain confidence that you did know there would be this return to normalcy at some point?
Well, the reason it was easy to maintain confidence was because our businesses continued to increase their value. So even though their prices languished, their values grew. So in other words, let's imagine that you owned as an asset, you know, a well-located apartment building somewhere. And that apartment building, you know, you had paid, let's just make up a number, say you had paid $10 million for that apartment building. And when you bought it, it was generating $800,000 of income. So you'd say, oh, well, I'm getting about an 8% return on my $10 million. And let's say year after year, that $800,000 that it was earning grew. So after 5 years, it was up to $1.5 million of income on your $10 million investment. You'd say, "Woo, I'm doing pretty good. I'm getting like 15% every year, and it's still growing." Now, that's the value. Now, contrast that with, suppose you said, "Well, I know these earnings are going up, but I can't find somebody that wants to buy my apartment building for what I paid for it. I paid $10 million, and some joker just came along and offered me $7 million. You know, Jesus, I'm down 30%. Well, of course you wouldn't think that. You'd be like, well, I don't have to sell it. My God, the earnings are going up like crazy. I'm not going to sell it at $7 million. Then somebody comes along and says, oh, let's make it $5 million. You'd say, I'm certainly not going to sell it at $5 million. So what happened in our portfolio and what allowed us to maintain conviction in our investment discipline was the value, the earnings of our companies grew during this 10 years, and in many cases grew faster than the market averages. So the earnings, the companies kept getting more valuable, and yet the valuation that the market was willing to pay for ours kept going down. And it kept going down because the companies were out of fashion, because people were valuing remote future earnings more than those nearby earnings. They were valuing, you know, aggressive growth assumptions, whatever it was. But we were able to keep conviction because every year we would say, wow, the earnings that our companies are generating keep growing, growing at a very attractive rate relative to the indexes. And the fact that people are paying a lower and lower valuation for them, well, we can wait that out. Now, if the opposite had been happening, if our portfolio was underperforming but the company's earnings were deteriorating or they were being disintermediated, you know, look at fintech, you know, that was going to destroy banking. And, you know, if that had happened, we would have, it would have been a mistake for us to own some of the banks that we own. But, of course, it didn't. The banks did an amazing job. They outlasted the fintech bubble burst. Those companies collapsed, and the underlying companies now are swinging back into favor. So in that sense, it was difficult emotionally because you hated to have people trust you with their money and not be outperforming. But on the other hand, we were growing in absolute terms. Our returns were good. And relatively, our companies were outperforming even though their prices were languishing.
Chris, just a few minutes left here. I mentioned at the top that Davis does offer four ETFs. And let me briefly run through those. So there's the Davis Select U.S. Equity ETF, ticker DUSA. There's the Davis Select Worldwide ETF, DWLD. You also have an international ETF, DINT, and then a financial ETF, DFNL. Just at a high level, what will investors find here? Like, if you were to take your basic framework and just explain what investors are going to find in these ETFs, how would you describe that?
Well, we started our active ETFs as truly transparent, true ETFs, something like 6 or 7 years ago. So we were really pioneers. And we chose the specific investment strategies where we thought active management over time will add the most value. So we were very contrarian first in thinking about DUSA, a concentrated, truly active U.S. ETF. Low turnover, value discipline, fundamental approach. And there are three words that characterize these ETFs. One is they're selective. So instead of 500 companies in the index, we might own 30 or 40. Two, our companies are growing at good rates. So they're selective, they're growing, and then most importantly is the last part, they are undervalued. They are trading at valuations that in many cases are 30, 40, 50% of the market averages. So DUSA, concentrated U.S., look nothing like the index, add value by being selective, growing, and undervalued. Second was when we looked globally and internationally, that's where index investors really feel comfortable owning these global indexes. We think that's crazy because the indexes have so many companies and so many of them are lousy. So that we feel selectivity can really add value when you get outside the U.S. So a worldwide global strategy and an international strategy where we can, again, be selective, focus on companies that are growing and undervalued. And finally, the financial ETF. That's a little bit of a pet project of mine because I started our actively managed traditional financial mutual fund more than 33 years ago. We've outperformed both the S&P and the financials indexes since then. So the financials index and the S&P 500 for over 30 years. And one of the things we realized is when people wanted exposure to financials, they were buying things like the XLF, these financial strategies that look like an index and yet have 40 or 50% in only 4 or 5 stocks. So the index in the case of financials is almost overly concentrated in the largest companies. So we felt there was an opportunity, as we have over 30 years in the traditional mutual fund business, to add value as an actively managed financials ETF as a real alternative to the XLF with a little bit more diversification and, as I say, in our mutual fund over time, better results. So that's sort of our key strategy, is being selective to identify companies that have good, durable growth and are undervalued. And that characterizes our ETFs, and we think we're moving into a period of active management coming back into bloom, value mattering again, the end of this crazy zero money bubble. And we wanted to make sure we had that alternative available, particularly for advisors with whom we've built our business over the last 40 or 50 years, that they wanted to have ETFs in their quiver. And we said we can offer you true, actively managed ETFs that are fully transparent, not hybrids. And as I said, we did it, and we were very lonely for the first 5 years, but now it seems that it's finally catching on. But that tends to be our approach, Nate. We tend to be early. We tend to try to put out there what we would want to invest in if our roles were reversed.
You certainly were early in the active ETF space. Before I let you go, I have to ask you, just as somebody who covers the ETF space very closely, when I was looking, it has been over, 6 years, 7 years since you last launched an ETF. You do have a number of other strategies in other wrappers. Could we see any new ETFs moving forward?
Well, it's possible, Nate, but I'll give you the commitment that we always make to our clients, is that we won't launch anything that we don't want to put our own money in at that time. And that's very contrary to the way a lot of the investment industry works, which is, you know, what's hot right now? What's gone up a lot? Let's get a product out there and sell it into this high demand. We're the opposite. We sort of say, what's out of favor? What are people going to like 3 years, 5 years from now? What looks good then? And let's start it, and let's put our own money in it. So anytime we launch an ETF or a fund, for that matter, we do it because we see an investment opportunity, not a marketing or asset gathering opportunity, but an investment opportunity. And we lead by putting our own money in it, our family money, my partners, our colleagues, our firm, our directors. We lead from the front that way. And so right now, we love the four strategies that are out there. But I can promise you, if we do launch another one, it will be because we see a peculiar opportunity in that underlying that particular investment approach. So I like where we are now. I like that we were early, and I sure like the four ETFs that are out there, and I've got my own money in all of them.
I absolutely love that last point, because I did see where Davis portfolio managers and employees and other interested parties have something like over $2 billion invested in Davis strategies. And so clearly you're eating your own cooking, and quite frankly, I don't think that gets talked enough about in the investment world. I think that's very important to see an active manager, you know, sort of putting their money where their mouth is. But Chris, we're going to have to leave it there. I really appreciate you taking the time this week. Truly tremendous insight into the current markets and active management and your ETF lineup. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you so much, Nate. It's been a pleasure.
That was Chris Davis, Chairman and Portfolio Manager at Davis Advisors. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. Next week, I'll be joined by Kristen Myers, Editor-in-Chief at ETF.com. We're going to preview the upcoming ETF.com Awards, which I will actually be attending next week, so I can't wait to discuss that. Until then, have a great week, everyone.